sein, deins.
Das ist aber noch nicht an. Ah, jetzt.
Okay. Welcome everybody for the last session this year on this stage. And I'm happy to have two guests. They will discuss about Agitprop in the 21st century, memes as transgressive art, education and political weapons. Like newspapers, radio and television, the internet can be used as a tool for opinion shaping in the hands of either the left or the right. Two administrators from Socialist Meme Caucus will discuss now philosophical, artistic and political challenges in using social networks to their best potential. And I'm very happy to have here David Redelberger. He studied nanostructure and molecular sciences at the University of Kassel, and he likes memes, social media, cats, the left-wing politics. He is an active member of Die Linke in Germany, the Left Youth and Socialist Alternative. And our second guest, Edmund Schlüssel. He comes from Helsinki. He is a member of the Committee for a Workers' International. He has taken part in trade union, student union, and anti-fascist work as a radical activist since 2009. And now I will give you stage to the both of them. And you have the possibility to ask questions anytime. So that means I'm standby with my microphone. You can give me a sign and I will come to you. And yeah, feel free to ask something.
Yeah, thank you, host, and welcome, everyone. Nice to have you here. Yeah, what we want to talk about is this. As she said already, if you have understanding questions, just ask them in between, and if you have longer questions, ask at the end. We'll have a talk for about 20 minutes, and then you have plenty of time to ask questions. We have three main things we want to talk about: the artistic roots of the political left, the possibilities and limitations of social media, and the narrow line between humor and seriousness. These are our three main things we want to talk about. And yeah, we have been introduced already. Yeah, this is us. You know that already, but if you want to follow us on Twitter, there's our Twitter handles, and our hashtag for this session is socialist memes. So if you want to tweet something, feel free. We're very happy about that. We just want to start with some basics. Who in the room does not know what a meme is? Nice. So we can sort of skip that. Just a few words on that. But it's generally not necessarily a picture or a video, but an idea carrying unit is what Wikipedia says about it. And yeah, an internet meme, of course, is a meme spreading via the web. Can be like what you have on Twitter, some hashtag games or whatever. But obviously, 90% of internet memes is videos or pictures, but yeah, that's it. Yeah, can be a lot of cats as well. So what is Socialist Meme Caucus? We're a Facebook page mainly. We have a Twitter account, which is rather small, but a bigger Facebook page, which was founded in 2011 with 64,000 likes, and we position ourselves within the political left in the tendency of Trotskyism. So Trotsky was the guy who fought Stalin in the Soviet Union, who stands for socialist democracy, and was murdered by one of Stalin's agents in 1940. And yeah, we do our work, what we do to achieve a democratic socialist society. That's why we are active memeing and stuff. We have been quoted scientifically. So there's several citations. I thought this one was quite nice from the book Reconsidering Value and Labor in the Digital Age. And there, Christian Fuchs, he's a university professor, he said about us, Socialist Meme Caucus is also driven by critical social and economic ideologies. It is intentionally humorous and lighthearted, but nevertheless expands the public expression of alternative social and political models. But of course, we're not the only show in town. There are also other nice pages. This is courtesy of socialist, sassy socialist memes. And the Vice wrote about that topic a few weeks ago. You can read that article. It's quite interesting how meme culture is getting into Marxism. So this for an introduction. And now I'll give Edmund the mic.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you. Can I have the clicky thing? Good. Yes. Hi. Yeah. My role in this whole thing is I'm one of the main content creators for the page, and I've taken over as the lead administrator over the past couple of years as well for Socialist Meme Caucus. And there it goes. And I want to talk a bit about the artistic directions we're coming from and how the artistic ideas and the politics interact. Now, internet memes, usually we're talking about combinations of text and images, mixed media, captions on videos, captions on photographs. Historically, there's been a prejudice against this kind of mixed media in mass culture. This quote from Alice in Wonderland illustrates the sort of psychology around it, how the idea that all text was the adult form of communication and mixing text and pictures was for children, but in practice, we find that when we don't use these multiple channels of communication at once, we exclude a lot of the audience. People learn in different ways. They receive ideas in different ways. And in different circumstances, people can be visual learners, audible learners, text learners, whatever. This book here on the right, Understanding Comics by MacLeod, is one of three in a series, which I ran across about 10 years ago, and which really gets into the meat of how text and images can be effectively created. He really breaks down at the most basic level. I highly recommend his series. The case for mixed media art presentation as a way of communicating ideas. And certainly, there's been this idea in mass politics for a long time of using mixed media, combinations of text and pictures, trying to communicate with people on multiple symbolic and iconic levels at once. This illustration here, this is by an artist named Walter Crane, who did a lot of illustrations for the Labour Party in the United Kingdom in the 19th and early 20th centuries. He was also a renowned children's artist. Now, this is from 1885. Look at the visual language that's being used here. It's operating at a very, very basic level. He's taken a couple of iconic images from outside the political sphere. You have an angel and a vampire attacking a person, and simply attach labels to the ideas, as you would find in many political cartoons. And this is operating at a quite low level when we're talking about a working class in Britain at this time that is very big, but is only at the most basic levels of political experience. The Labour Party is still an embryonic idea. The idea of a mass organization of the working class is still finding its feet. Marx has written and expressed his ideas in the First International and the Second International have happened. But there hasn't been that crystallization through action. For the average person, the idea of, in Britain at least, the idea of what is a socialist movement, what does that look like, is still coming together. Now, click. There we go. Advancing just a couple of years, we see a much higher level of abstraction here. This is a panel from A Man's Passion, the Passion Eines Menschen. This is from a German genre called wordless novels, which reached their peak in the 1920s in immediately post-revolutionary Germany. And when I'm talking about the level of abstraction, there's no more words here. What Masurel is trying to do here, is his assumption is that his audience is people who can see this image and extract meaning from it without any words. Someone will automatically have the ideas in their head, the symbols in their head. This is what this looks like. This is his protagonist in this novel, which, as I say, is a wordless novel. It's a collection of pictures, woodcuts, taking part in an uprising against his factory manager. And this is entirely communicated through immediate images. It reaches down into the id very powerfully. And these wordless novels have... Click, please. There we go. These wordless novels have had a profound impact on the art that we look at today. This is Will Eisner, the American artist, specifically cited German wordless novels as an influence on the modern graphic novel genre. And if you talk about people like Alan Moore or Warren Ellis, you're looking at a return to political graphic novels, V for Vendetta, things like that. But we're going in a bit of a different direction in Socialist Meme Caucus. Something we found with memes is that single panels tend to work a lot better, and so our primary inspiration is the constructivist school in the Soviet Union and that spread across Europe, again in the same period that we're talking about, the end of the First World War and the revolutionary phase that followed that. And what the constructivists were doing is they were trying to break down barriers between genres, so there's a lot of mixed media. A lot of the constructivist artists, people like Popova or Rodchenko, didn't consider themselves to be simply graphic designers or simply photographers, but people who were comfortable in a wide range of media and declared things like, this is the end of painting, this is the synthesis of art. But we're also very good at creating these things that are right on the border between the symbolic and iconic levels of abstraction. So we've got these bright colors all over the place, these geometric designs that leap out at you at the page, and the sort of blocky text goes along with it, a very simple palette that engages the viewer, and then, once you have the viewer's attention, then you can have the more detailed photographic elements. You've seen Rodchenko's work if you have seen that famous Buy Books advertisement, the one with the woman crying out. It's all in Cyrillic. If you don't speak Russian, you may have not known it was about books. So that is one of our primary inspirations for a couple of reasons that we'll talk about now. One reason that we make memes in this sort of... My God, that resolution has turned out terribly. One of the reasons that we make memes in this sort of way is, firstly, none of us really in Socialist Meme Caucus are trained artists. I cannot draw worth a damn. I am horrible with a pen and paper. But by using the collage approach, by basically finding pictures on the internet and gluing them together, this is supposed to be Lenin and the Spice Girls, by the way. I'm sorry, it looked a lot better on my laptop. We're taking that sort of Rodchenko approach of cutting out pieces of photographs and attaching them to backgrounds. Not just because it's easy, but because it's also very accessible. It's something that people can engage in much more readily, and we encourage people to produce their own stuff and put it on our page, and if we like it, then we share it. A lot of our most popular pieces have been from other people. There is also that conscious connection back to the constructivists of the early 20th century, of that revolutionary mood. There is a sort of retro approach to it. But it is something that works very well on the web, where people are not looking at an image for more than a couple of seconds, where they're just scrolling. Oh, that's bright colors. That's a shiny object. I will latch onto that. Interfacing with their audience, engaging with their audience, making certain assumptions about how they're taking in information has been extremely important in making what we're doing accessible. Too far? This is basically just a diagram of the sort of thinking that we're going through. If you've ever read or seen Ways of Seeing by Berger, you know that art is an interaction between the audience and the artist, and the medium of the art is only a means to an end. But you can go beyond that. If you explore the history of constructivist art, if you explore the history of all political art, you see that there is this constant dialogue and this constant evolution of medium. And a sort of logical endpoint of that, if you look at the acceleration of that the internet allows, is that we can have this one-on-one engagement with our audience where they tell us, well, that didn't work so well, this worked better. This one, well, we see that it didn't get many likes, so it didn't engage many people. We see that some of them got a lot more likes. We have those nice handy metrics in front of our face. And this was one of the most popular things that we did. This, again, with the resolution, I swear it looked legible on my laptop. This is a portrait, a photograph of Eric Robert Rudolph, who was the terrorist who attacked the 1996 Olympics and also carried out a number of homophobic and quote-unquote pro-life terror attacks in the United States in the mid-90s. And all this is it's the same photograph of Rudolph repeated six times with different levels of saturation and contrast and with an evolving message talking about the crimes he committed versus a parallel treatment where Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the Boston bomber, was treated much more harshly in the media and in the courts. I need to speed up a bit here. Ending with the message, it's nice being white and Christian in America. So what we're talking about here is we're not siding with terrorists at all, but at the same time we're saying even with these absolute worst people, these mass murderers, there's still preferential treatment being carried out in the justice system in the U.S., for the established representatives of the ruling class, for white people, for Christians. Similarly, why does this one show up and the others don't? During the election in the United States, we had a big struggle, as you've seen around the world, with the problem of very wet, mild, lesser evilism. In opposition to independent action of the working class. And something that happened very frequently in that election was that the genuine achievements of feminist activists were being absolutely obscured by this ultra-neoliberal behemoth of the Hillary Clinton campaign. And this here got 16,000 shares. This was, I think, one of our top three most popular shares. And what we've done here to put this together is we've got Hillary Clinton as icon. You see that face, you know immediately what that's associated with. And then we have all these smaller portraits. This is every woman who has been a nominee for a president since the earliest is 1872, when Victoria Woodhull, who wasn't even allowed to vote for herself in that election. And so we've got the iconic image drawing you in, and then all these little smaller pieces, all the smaller portraits that you can find out more about. And that's starting with consciousness of the audience at a very immediate level and then bringing them in, engaging them into a discussion. This is one of the things that I'm most famous, not famous I should say, but most proud about because it got a considerable international coverage. UKIP, obviously a far-right populist organization in the United Kingdom where I was living, and eventually I left the UK because the immigration rules there didn't allow me to stay there. They had a free post address. A free post is where you can send something to the organization and they will pay the postage. And so we put together this, where we encouraged people using UKIP's same imagery, same colors, never the word UKIP itself, but their ideas taken to a heightened parodic level, and encouraged people to send them bricks, which they then had to pay postage for. And this is one of the great examples of virality, first of all, because you know, if we just put something on a web page, nothing happens. But people pick up on it, they like the idea, they start sending bricks, they get their friends to send bricks. After about a week, UKIP had to shut down their free post account because some poor person in Devon was just getting brick after brick after brick. And this really took off beyond all belief. Twitter picked up on it and became a whole campaign. So yeah, this is something that I'm very happy with the outcome because it's something very tangible. But one of the big problems that we face is how do we get people to make that jump from internet meme to action? This is always the big thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's easy to click like, it's easy to click share. But how do you get them to undertake some concrete step? I do not have a magic formula for you there. I do not have an answer. All you can really do is know your audience, and I'll go back one here, use what we call the transitional approach in Trotskyism. It's sort of a brand thing, so I have to mention it. But basically the idea is transitional approaches, you have a bridge. You have where your audience is. Where is the working class? What are they thinking right now? What are they willing to do? What is in their heads? What is their immediate issue? You have, as a left activist, you have an idea of what you think society is supposed to be. And if you're from a Marxist background, you're saying the only way we can get from here to there is action. So the transitional approach is, what kind of action can you take? What can you recommend people do that fits in with what they're willing to do, with what they're capable of at their given level of organization? And that is the hardest task in all radical politics, in my opinion, is finding that little piece, that task that is progressive, that has a meaningful outcome, and that they are able and willing to do. So I'll just wrap up with the conclusions from my section. Yep. Transitionalism, can you find what people are thinking about? Can you find the mood? What can you get into an image? An honest-to-God artist could do a lot more with this than any of us can. Yeah, we're all amateurs at this. We're just struggling in the dark, guessing, and we're very lucky to have that direct feedback that the internet provides, where we can talk to our audience and where we can get some idea of what works and what doesn't. But someone who actually had graphic design ideas could really take off with something like this. I will say, when we have multi-panel stuff, it doesn't tend to do very well. It's too many images at once on a phone screen or something like that. Too wordy tends not to do very well either. If you can get something down to a slogan of 3 or 4 words, that's great. Three or four words, iconic image, that's great. And lastly, activism versus collectivism. I think I've basically covered that in my points so far, but I'll hand back over to David for some further conclusions.
Yeah, so I'll do the last two slides, and then you're always happy to ask questions. So the thing is, what about humor or seriousness? Well, it's both poles of some memes we shared. But who of you thinks a meme should be humorous? Who thinks it should be serious? Well. That's what I thought. Most of you think it should be humorous, but since we have a political approach, it's a bit of a narrow line we're walking. If it should be serious or humorous, but we have some. We don't have a recipe for it. We do both, and we can't really say. But we have some general rules. What about should be? And as I said, there's not a completely. Right way, but we have some rules, which is we make fun of the oppressor, not of the oppressed. So we don't use racism, sexism, homo, transphobia, and anti-Semitism, ableism, and so on. Anything that is discrimination from making fun of people, but we don't punch down. But we make fun of the oppressor, and we take for example, we often share memes from Memorial Days. We take these seriously. We don't make fun of that. That's for sure. And we develop ourselves in that. What we do, because there has been a discussion. There was an incident in the British Socialist Workers Party, which is a bigger left party in the UK, and there was a case of rape which was covered up by them, and this led to discussions within all of the left, and we decided to not post anything about that, because we can't you can't take it like that, because it's a rape case. You can't do stuff about it, because people will feel bad about it, and or there can be triggers and stuff like that. But what we do is we post macabre stuff. So yeah, this is a series we were doing for the UK election. So Corbyn or May, what is their stance on feeding children? And Corbyn is free schools, meals for all primary children, and May is feeding them to whom? So we do macabre stuff. That's that's for sure. And I wanted to end with. One meme which was made by reality, which just popped up on the mobile phone of one of our admins. We're about 18 admins, I think, on the page. And sometimes just reality makes the best jokes. This was just popping up on the phone in the trending news, and it is one of our best shared pictures of the last year, I would say. It was posted in January, I think, and yeah, it was still one of the best shared memes we have. And yeah, this is where we want to end. Check out our Facebook page if you like, follow us on Twitter, and yeah, ask questions. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for this interesting introduction. It is the last session here, so we can have 5 or 10 more minutes, so feel free to ask some questions, and I will come with the microphone to you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your talk. I really liked it. I guess what I like most is, I think yesterday or the day before, we heard about the identitarian movement, the Identitäre Bewegung, who do use the internet as well for their, yeah, let's call it propaganda. Let's be serious here. And they employ some really top-to-bottom things, like they will tell you how to structure it, what kind of font you have to use, how to point your camera, stuff like that. And I really like that this... what I saw from you, it doesn't work like this at all. It's really individual stuff, and it's really, egalitarian in its way. And I think it's really great. You could see, kind of your ideology in these pictures, and I think that's really cool.
Some more questions? Come on. Yeah.
Hey, I heard that people from the alt-right movement referred to the Trump or the U.S. The U.S. elections as the Great Meme War, because as they said, memes played such an important role in that. And of course, they were the guys coming from 4chan and so on, who more or less invented this kind of memetic warfare, as it's called. By the NATO, how important would you say is that really? I mean, speaking about national elections.
All right. Well, okay. I think it was Robert Paxton, the historian of fascism, who said that fascism is a movement more of the gut than of the mind. And this creates a bit of a difficulty because the playing field is not going to be level for us in the online space. It is easier to get people stirred up and angry around their existing prejudices than to educate them and to get them moving on a more positive message. So I wouldn't say that there was a meme war so much as the internet gave each side a megaphone allowed each side's ideas to spread to an already established audience. I don't see a ton of overlap between the audience for Socialist Meme Caucus and the audience of people who are sharing quote-unquote alt-right peppy memes. I just did not see that happening very much. Instead, it's more echo chambered, the entire thing. It's the right wing, especially the extreme right wing, is more confident in its ideas because they are hearing their own message so much louder from each other. And while there is a solidarity element on the left of using memes for this, our mission isn't quite that. Our mission is educate and agitate and organize, whether or not that's in the electoral sphere. So I wouldn't say that there was a big clash going on there.
Yeah, I would add that we often have memes where or just share articles as well for people to read and to educate themselves, and not just for the sake of sharing and for the sake of getting interaction and high like numbers or whatever, but for this purpose. And but what we do sometimes, we had like a wave of transphobic comments on some memes, and there was debate and stuff. We shut them down at some point. It it was just transphobism all and all around, and we needed to shut some of them down, as you know that it can escalate quite quickly, and we had to take measures there. But this was not a big battle with the right, but it was still a battle.
Some more questions? Somebody? Okay.
Hi. I actually came just to the very tail end of the presentation, so if I missed it, I'm sorry. Please forgive it. It's a stupid question. A big topic for the entire Republica has been fake news. And I troll 9GAG all day, so this is kind of like my biggest source of information. But it seems to me a lot that memes can kind of contribute to fake news being propagated. What do you guys think?
Well, I would say what we said at the beginning that or was said in the introduction that it is. Meme is a tool rather than a content, so it can be used for fake news, sure, but it can be used for real news, in so to say, or for political education and stuff like we do. It can be used as well, so it's a tool, and the important point is what is behind it and what is the content. And we try to we focus on political education. So we if possible, we share articles or something like that with it. Not necessarily. Sometimes not. But we have a different approach and take our work seriously. But sure, memes can be used for fake news. That's true.
Yeah. It depends how far down the rabbit hole you want to go with the answer, because on the one hand, we try to make sure that everything that we share is accurate. In fact, this morning I deleted something, the Assange thing, because it turned out Assange never actually said that, and so I got rid of it. And that does happen a lot, is we'll propagate something that turns out to have been based on a bad report or a fake report or something. And usually we just quietly send it down the memory hole and hope not too many people were fooled by it like we were. But on a deeper level, what do you call facts and what do you call fake news in a world where all media is intrinsically biased in the hands of the owner, for good or for ill? Something that Trotsky writes about in Revolution in Literature is how there cannot really be an independent working class culture until you've abolished bourgeois society in the first place. And the left is still in this position that we are not setting the tone, really. We have to respond to what capitalist media is producing, whether it's neoliberal or neoconservative. And when you put something that is objectively true, that can often be very confrontational. I'm a scientist. I am so fed up with people saying that global warming isn't happening when I can go to talk to any atmospheric scientist and they'll run down books and books of data for me. But then I'm a socialist and I have to deal with this orthodoxy of, the wage price model, how capitalism liberates people, how feminism doesn't need to exist anymore because the feminist mission was completed in the early 20th century, and all this nonsense, which is objectively not true, which you can disprove again and again just by looking around you, but you actually tell someone that and they think you're from Mars. Sorry, I'm getting a little worked up about this, but that is always the challenge, because as socialists, we are trying to put forward truth that exists whether people believe it or not. And we're living in a society, we are swimming in this polluted atmosphere of propagandization from birth about this is the world that we're supposed to be in. And Marx loved Hegel, but sometimes I just want to smack Hegel, because if this is the end of history, then I want to change cars.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any last question? No? Okay, thank you very much for coming. and for listening. And this was the last session on the stage, but feel free to stay here and relax, and there will be still a lot of program going on the other stages. So enjoy the day and the night.